Hello and welcome to another edition of the Armchair Directors. For each episode, we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week, we are looking at the public domain film noir, The Chase, directed by the talented Arthur Ripley. Returning on the show today to talk about The Chase is Professor Meridar. Professor Dutter, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
Did you get that little pun I made at the beginning?
Yes, I did.
Okay, I want to make sure.
Yeah, no, Ripley, got it. Arthur Ripley actually was kind of cool, though. He started off with working with Frank Capra with a guy called Max Sennett in the 1920s.
Yeah, and Max Sennett was huge in like the early silent era. I think he worked with Chaplin. I'm pretty sure the Keystone Cops, like every Fatty Arbuckle, maybe even Buster Keaton. He worked with everybody during the silent era.
Arthur Ripley and the fact that he's working and writing with Frank Capra too is also, I think, kind of amazing that they both started to get their first feet in the water as being writers for mostly vaudevillian things. Which I think is kind of interesting because vaudeville relies a lot on gags, which is important to silent film, but also some of the jokes, which of course would have just been title cards then. And so yeah, you talking about Max Sennett is really important because you're right; he was major in the 1920s.
Yeah, and then even continuing his theme of comedy, I know in the 30s he started working with W.C. Fields. I read about that. He did shorts with him.
Yeah, and I guess there was a lot of emphasis put on this one guy named Lawton, and that when Lawton left Sennett, that's when Frank Capra and Arthur Ripley left with Lawton when he left. So even though Sennett was able to go on and still do, you know, put out amazing content all through the 20s and the 30s, you see Arthur Ripley's career taking a bit of a turn when he leaves with Lawton in order to stay with him and Capra. And then Capra leaves Lawton in order to go and do his thing, and eventually Ripley leaves to go and do his thing. And so there's a lot of... he's really not predominantly a director. He's done twice as much writing, or has twice as many writing credits
credits. Yeah, looking at his IMDb, there's not a lot of films he's directed, as far as like feature-length films. He's done this... some film in the 40s called Voices in the Wind, and a film in the late 50s called Thunder Road with Robert Mitchum.
Right. He did a lot of shorts, and he did a lot of TV in the 1950s. And it was a real mixed bag, too. It was westerns, it was detective stuff, it was comedy stuff. So it's kind of funny when you do your opening spiel about, you know, the great directors and their films. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't necessarily say that Arthur Ripley was a great director.
No.
But I do think, you know, the staying power that he had inside the industry and how he worked in it for 40 years, you know, he's got, you know, a lot of notches on his bedpost as far as all the things that he had his hands in.
Yeah, and there's a lot of, we always talk about, we think of, like, you know, directors and stuff, we think of somebody as, like, you know, iconic, especially in the 40s or 50s, like, you know, your Hitchcocks or your Capras or your Fords or your Houstons and everything. But not every, you know, there are a lot of directors who made movies, maybe not, they weren't the biggest hits, so not extremely well-remembered, but they put together a lot of stuff, or even when TV came, they worked a lot on that, too. You don't know their names, but, I think Arthur Ripley really fits in that, where nothing really stands out, but they just did a lot of work, and, you know, they... Whenever a studio wanted them to do a movie, they said, "All right, we'll get Arthur Ripley."
Yeah, he's a journeyman. He's highly reliable, and and I think that this movie, The Chase, really kind of shows off certain things about him, like his sense of humor and some of his ideas about staging and romance. And I also kind of see this as almost a template for film noir movies. Because you have all the ingredients in there, except for maybe one, but we'll talk about the ending probably at some point in this.
Yeah, so...
Because I think the ending is really interesting in this movie.
Yeah, I would say that just talking about this film is that it completely fell apart for me in the third act. And I'll spoiler alert for anybody who hasn't seen this movie yet. It looks like it's a murder mystery. He's the wrong man, committed to the crime, very Hitchcockish. and he's the wrong man, committed of the murder of the woman he loved. He goes on the run, and then he gets to like this shootout thing. It looks like he's been knocked on the head or he's out cold, and then reveal none of that happened, that it was all this like hallucination thing, because this is a war vet and he has PTSD, and none of that happened. And I thought, and that just completely baffled me. And I'm just thought you come. I watched the film. I was like, what? Like, you just completely lost me.
Well, but I think there's a couple of things here that are really interesting. One, this movie was made in 1946. Now, we don't start seeing post-traumatic stress disorder talked about a lot in films until the beginning of the 1950s. Or even psychology, for that matter. You really don't have a ton of emphasis on that. And, you know, this is the year after the war was over, and you did have a lot of veterans. I mean, when we see and I love our main character's name, Chuck Scott. Like, the best name ever. You have two first names, Chuck Scott. But the first part where we see him, he's down on his luck. He's broke.
Yep.
He's, like, looking hungrily in a window. He can't afford to eat. You know, he takes a pill, and we don't find out later, you know, that it's because of PTSD that he's taking these pills, and that he has these lapses that he blacks out and can't remember what's going on. But this is one of the first films that really even pays any kind of lip service to these returning vets and the situation that they're in. You would think, with all the fanfare that we would see at the end of the war and VJ Day and VE Day, that the veterans would have been maybe being taken care of a little bit better. And this guy, you know, Chuck Scott, doesn't seem like a bad guy. I mean, he finds that wallet, and it's full of money. And instead of, you know, running off with all that money,
he just uses a little.
Obviously broke.
He just uses a little bit of it back. And then gives it back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And he even says, when he goes to take the wallet back, Eddie Roman, our antagonist in the film, is like, so how much money's in it? And he says exactly how much it was and how much he took out for breakfast. And Eddie looks over at Gino, you know, because Peter Lorre is so Italian, and says, oh, what about that? A nice guy, an honest guy. And Gino's just like, he's a jerk.
Yeah, yeah. Silly,
what
silly,
honesty?
Silly law-abiding jerk.
Yeah, stupid law-abiding jerk.
Yeah, I do.
So, yeah.
But it was 1946. I do think there was one other film that kind of showed this as far as veterans' difficulty in readjusting, getting back to their regular lives. Was The Best Years of Our Lives, William Wyler.
Yeah.
And those same year, and it shows, you know, somebody with a disability who lost one of their arms in an accident, which the actor actually did have that happen to him. And then you also have I forget the guy's name, but that character who was like a bombardier pilot or something, he has like nightmares and flashbacks. So they were starting to, 1946 with this movie, and they were starting to address that issue.
Yeah, and The Best Years of Our Lives definitely got a lot more attention coming from Wyler, one of the five directors. If you follow the Five Came Back series, you know, he's one of the guys that they concentrate on. So, yeah, they do start getting into it. Now, it's been a really long time since I've seen that movie. Does anybody take any medication for PTSD at that point in that movie?
I don't believe so, because the only one who really has heavy PTSD is the one guy who was Dana Andrews is the actor. Dana Andrews' character, he has the nightmares, but I don't remember him taking any pills. The other guys have difficulties, but they don't have, like, flashbacks or nightmares or hallucinations or anything.
Yeah, and the thing that this guy goes through, and you know, when you get to that part where you said it falls apart, and the first time I saw the movie, I felt very much like you did. I'm just like, oh, this is cheap. It's like a Dallas sort of thing. Oh, the whole thing was
a dream.
But then when you get past that, and you're trying to see him figure out, well, was it a dream, or is this something that I haven't done yet? He keeps looking at the clocks because he's not sure. You know, is this something that I still need to do? He's got all this anxiety, but he doesn't know why. And the doctor's trying to talk him out of it and go, look, you know your situation. You know you've been in this kind of place before. Even when they go to have a bar at the drink, he's like, you know, turn the clock around because this guy's a clock watcher.
Yeah.
You know, he's desperately trying to figure out if this stuff is real or not and who all these people are. So I think it's really kind of interesting because, yeah, the best years of our lives wasn't playing with kid gloves when they were talking about veterans' experience. But it seems like the way that Chuck Scott is dealing with this reality is pretty difficult and maybe in some senses even more dire than what we see with the characters in Best Years of Our Lives.
Yeah, and I think, like I said, this film did fall apart for me. I do think it could have been a lot better if you just rearrange the story a little bit, like introduce, because the thing for me is they don't really, in the beginning of the film, like you say, he takes some pills, but there's never any instances where he has flashbacks or he, you know, you can see him like when he's not on the meds and he's just messed up. They don't show that at all. If they show that,
that
would be a better buildup and payoff than we say, oh, now we get it. But it seems very sudden in the film. I think if you change that a bit and have it sort of where he... It sort of doesn't have that whole beginning, but it shows him, like, during that time, and he's trying to figure out what exactly is going on, maybe even a bit like, I don't know, like a Memento sort of thing. I think you could have a really a much stronger movie, but the way this film was done and the telling of it, I thought it just really fell flat for me.
Well, I also would be really interested because the movie is based on a Cornell Woolrich novel, The Black Path of Fear. Mm-hmm. And I love, love, love Cornell Woolrich. I mean, this is the guy that wrote what is used to
Rear Window.
Be the plot of Rear Window.
Yeah.
I mean, Cornell Woolrich, when you look at his IMDb page, has so many films attributed to him in the 40s and 50s. And he wrote so much film noir that I would be interested to see if the structure of the book is the same as the structure of the movie, because it may be if the structures are the same that maybe some of the stuff about Chuck Scott has been omitted, you know, because this movie isn't very long. It's an hour and 26 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like you get a ton of information about Chuck Scott early on other than he's hungry and he's broke and he's honest and he's a war veteran. Because the stuff, you're right, you know, if the first time I watched it, until I got to that point where he has his episode, I didn't know that he was suffering from PTSD or that he was on medication for it. So, yeah, they really didn't flesh that out really well. So I would definitely agree with you on that. But it may be that, you know, maybe in the hands of a more competent director or a more competent editor, because for all we know, that ended up on the editing floor, that it would have maybe been a little bit easier to put those things together. But then you've got the film noirish aspect where not everything is always really cut and dry and easy to follow, that we're supposed to be in the role that the protagonist is in, and that's why we're always off kilter with them and we don't know everything that's going on. Because that's why I say this is kind of like a template for film noir, because there's so many different elements and characteristics of film noir that get worked into this, whether it was on purpose or not.
Yeah, and you talk a lot about film noir. I do want to bring up, this film does help shine a light where people, I think, sometimes forget about when they think about film noir is the B-movie film noir. I think a lot of times when a lot of people think of film noir, they think of like the big Hollywood, the big budget ones like...
Right.
Maltese Falcon, The Big Sleep, you know, Double Indemnity with all the huge stars. They were under the huge studios, and they were big productions, got heavy. They were very heavily promoted and everything. There are a lot of film noirs that were made very cheaply. They were made by Poverty Row Studio Pictures. I think this company, I forget what it was probably one of them. And, you know, there are examples of this are Detour, which that's considered one of the greatest film noirs, especially in the B-movie category, and that was made on a Poverty Row picture. Another one is a DOA with Edmund O'Brien.
Yeah.
And this one, they fall by the wayside, I think, because people don't really think more of the, you know, the big ones with Humphrey Bogart or stuff, but these are very, can show you what you can do with a really small budget and maybe not as much talent from actor
yeah,
and actress.
Yeah, I would totally agree with you, because that's one of the things about film noir that is so central to why it is representative of this era, is because you had that kind of split that I think we talked about when we were talking about with Asphalt Jungle. You had the strong sense of trying to return to normalcy and everything is happy in La La Land and the musicals of the era, and then you had this gritty underbelly that was going into issues of psychology, issues of crime, And yeah, not all of them were made on really nice budgets that had, you know, the Warner Brothers lot that they were making them in. I mean, this movie was released by United Artists, but they're not the ones that funded it. They just distributed it. The guy that actually put it out is somebody named Seymour Nebenzahl. So you had basically an independent movie here, mm-hmm. With a not very well-known director, based on some really good film noir pedigree, and you were able to get Peter Lorre. I would love to know how Peter Lorre got into this picture.
Well, even you talking about the cast, like these, everybody in this film has been in notable stuff. So you got Peter Lorre, sure. Obviously, in a Maltese Falcon, or M, he was in Casablanca, and all that stuff. So Peter Lorre is the hugest star. But then you also have the veteran. It was played by Robert Cummings. He was the lead. He was the person Grace Kelly was having an affair with in Dial M for Murder. And interesting little fact, he was in the original television version of 12 Angry Men, the one that appeared 3 years before the film came out, Lumet's film.
Oh, cool.
And he played the Henry Fonda character in that one.
Oh, wow. That's a key role.
Yeah. And then the gangster, Eddie Roman, was Steve Cochran, and he was the power-hungry gangster in White Heat who tried to put one over on James Cagney. And then, interestingly, the lead actress who played the wife was Michelle Morgan. She was a French actress, and for a while she was considered for the Ingrid Bergman role in Casablanca. But Warner Brothers, RKO refused because Warner Brothers was going to give her too much money or something, not enough money, and so they didn't. But they were actually going to go with her first before Ingrid Bergman. And then one other person I want to talk about, he's not necessarily known in movies, but he's definitely known in radio, was Don Wilson. He plays Fats, the private investigator that shows up at the end with the information about them leaving on the boat. You might know, if people listen to like stuff like the Jack Benny Show, he was always the host. He did a lot of stuff on radio. So a lot of people notable in this movie.
Oh, yeah. I mean, these people are not slouches. And even what I like about the credits, the opening credit sequence, is they put Steve Cochran underneath courtesy of Sam Goldwyn. So some of these people, and I'm sure Peter Lorre was still attached to Warner Brothers at this point, because this is only 3 years, four years after he did Casablanca.
Yeah.
Even though this is obviously not a very big budget film, I think the performances in it are pretty good. And
yeah, they're pretty good.
Steve Cochran is horrible in this movie, not from like an acting perspective, but his character is just
cutthroat
and just brutal. And you know, you get that early on when you know he's getting his pedicure and his haircut. And the girl doing his pedicure kind of makes a mistake, and he just beats her.
Yeah.
She runs out of the room just crying.
Yeah, and it's a good performance. I think you really liked Peter Lorre, and you were really praising him in that email you sent me when you first told me about this film, and he's definitely kind of pulling that I forget the act, George Raft in Scarface, the second in command guy who's a tough guy.
Yeah.
And you never know quite what he's doing, but you always know that he's always willing to do the dirty work for his boss.
Yeah, I thought he was really funny in this movie because he just seems so lackadaisical in parts. Like he really couldn't, not Peter Lorre himself, but his character just seems to be not interested or invested in what's going on. He's really quick to come out with these like one-liners, and then there are times where he's just like rabid, where they're talking to Emmerich, where they are trying to get his boats from him.
Yeah.
And there he's like, well, so how much would you pay for him? And Peter Lorre just snarls nothing at him, like just like he's ready to go for his throat, and then they just kind of laugh it off. So the performance that Peter Lorre gives in this, and also going back to something you were saying earlier about how there's a lot of really low-budget film noirs, there's another one that stars Mickey Rooney, of all people, trying to be a badass. When you think of Mickey Rooney, you don't think badass. But he's in a film, and I'd have to look up the title, where
I think it's
he
called,
just continually gets... Do you know the title?
Quicksand, I believe. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I can actually
and
look
Peter
it up right
Lorre's
here.
And Peter Lorre's in that, too, and he also plays this really like skeezy, but definitely lethal character. I like when Peter Lorre pops up in these movies because he just brings something to the table that I don't think other actors at that time had, that sort of gravitas.
Yeah, and you did talk a little bit about just how this film's in the public domain, and this sort of brings up a big problem I have with one problem I have with this film, and it's not even necessarily the film itself, but it's just the fact that it's in the public domain. Now, public domain means it's absolutely legal to be posted anywhere to watch it because there's no copyright issues or anything. The big problem with that is the video quality of this is very, very poor. It's like 240p, and it makes it almost very hard to watch it. And you find that with a lot of public domain film noirs, like Detour, like DOA, or even an Orson Welles film called The Stranger. Like,
those
films are...
I've got that on, like, 3 different DVD packs.
Yeah, and they're all... If you watch them, they're all very poor quality. So that's sort of a big problem I have. It's just... Yes, it's free to watch it, but there's got to be some attempt to make some restoration because it's almost unwatchable in this film on video.
Yeah, I encountered a lot of that this summer when I was watching film noir. And the other one that I had suggested for this week, I don't even remember the title of it right now, but... It is almost unwatchable because of the tears in the film, and you can see where people have tried to put it back. There's no real try at restoring any negatives on this. I mean, like, this is the exact opposite of what we talked about with Asphalt Jungle, where Criterion Collection just put out a 2K digital restoration, remastered the mono track on the sound. This thing, it's out there, it exists, but nobody's really taking any care of it. And that's an overall problem that's happening at all studios, and even worse for these independent films that were made cheaply. Nobody's the guardian of these films. Nobody's taking care of it. If we can reproduce it on one of my film noir packs is literally 100 discs. There's 100 films in this film pack.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, they're all just kind of thrown together. Their sound quality is horrible. They don't have any subtitles, so you can't
use
the subtitles in order to try to figure things out that way. I think it's kind of a crime because while there is a push by things like some studios or Criterion or Kino Lorber or the Library of Congress when they do their 25 films each year that are entered into the Library of Congress National Film Registry. These are the ones that actually get some kind of attention, get some kind of restoration. But there's hundreds of thousands of films out there that, you know, nobody even knows where the negative is anymore. So I totally take your point. It's really, really hard to watch some of these because their quality is really poor. But then there's a part of me that goes, well, we haven't lost it yet. And now it's on YouTube, so it can't completely go away unless, you know, something happens to YouTube. It's kind of sad.
Yeah, that always annoys me. But there's even other films that have been in the public domain forever, yet get restored and have good quality. Like, you know, Nosferatu, I'm pretty sure the original one from 1922, I'm pretty sure that's still under public domain because there's like a bunch of copies you can find on YouTube. But a lot of those copies are in really good 720p condition. That means people have gone out and restored that. And I just don't know. There are other films, you know, and some of them are really good. Like, I'm not a huge fan of this film, but, like, stuff like Detour in DOA or in The Stranger, which is Orson Welles, somebody should go in there and restore them and get that Criterion or 720p, even if it means it loses its public domain. I don't mind as long as it can be a good quality copy to look at.
Yeah, I think that's interesting because... Because there are so many films out there, I mean, there's been estimations that we have lost half the silent era films.
Yep.
Just American silent era films. They're just not even around anymore. Like, there have been Academy Award silent era films that do not exist anymore. And you would think, okay, these are the things that our culture said are really important. Well, then you take a movie like this where, you know, me and maybe some people in like the Film Noir Society really, really dig it. But and even the Film Noir Society will do like a restoration picture every year or so. But it's very expensive. So it then becomes, well, what do we throw the life preserver at? what do we pull out from this and actually take the time and take the money and do it, and then, but that means all these other pictures are essentially sinking, they're drowning. And even with, and sometimes these, I don't understand these decisions anyway. Like, for example, there's the Freer Sackler Gallery has a film series that they do down at the Smithsonian, mm-hmm. and they're showcasing this month several Academy restorations. So the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences is also doing restorations on some of these films, and one of them is a Howard Hughes-backed film from, like, 1931 or 32 called Cock of the Air.
Oh, and interesting.
But they're not going to put it out on DVD. None of these things that they're doing are out for commercial purchase. So it's
that,
like,
makes no sense.
So you spent the time, you spent the money, you've restored this picture, and they've done this with other pictures too, but you're not even releasing it to maybe recoup some of the money that you spent on this project. I don't understand that either. Why would you go through all that only so that you can show it at limited film festivals every once in a while?
You got to show, yeah, it's something to show to the public, not just occasionally at a film festival, only if, you know, a handful of people will attend, but, you know, people who can pay, who'd be willing to pay money to, you know, to get a Criterion Blu-ray or whatever to get it.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like, I don't understand their reasoning behind that, because then you're starting to make it exclusive. And when you look at something like what the Library of Congress does, their goal is to make sure that these films are available to as many people as possible.
Yes.
Like a lot of the Library of Congress short films, like, you can watch them on YouTube, and they are sponsored by the Library of Congress. They have a little stinger in the beginning that says, you know, this is brought to you by the Library of Congress. You can stream them on YouTube. So why there would be this sort of limitation on what can be available to the public, I find that very distasteful.
Very.
It doesn't seem very fair.
It is baffling. Okay, so let's see. Getting close to the end of my questions, is there anything else you want to add or anything?
Well, I would just say, like, you can really literally fall down a black hole when it comes to going on places like YouTube, because, you know, they've always got that side, the right side of the screen that says, okay, autoplay, what's next? So if you like film noir, you know, even putting in something like The Chase into your search term and seeing the stuff that pops up on the right side of the screen, give some of these films a chance. Because, again, they're not Asphalt Jungle. They have not been restored by Criterion. But you could find some really, really interesting surprises. So especially mm-hmm. if you're a fan of a genre and, you know, you can deal with some quality issues, you can have a ton of fun. And I know mm-hmm. I did this summer. It was a lot of fun.
And I even found a decent quality 720p of DOA that was restored.
Oh, nice.
On YouTube.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, they're out there sometimes.
You got to dig around, you know.
You got to dig, yeah.
Okay, so then last question I'll have is, tell us a little bit about your classes.
Okay, so I have a Film 101 on Wednesday evenings. That's where we look at different aspects of filmmaking, and we look at a variety of films and different genres and apply different terms to the films. And I also have Introduction to American Cinema on Fridays, and that's just looking decade by decade at this American film that we have in this country, and, you know, going through genres like film noir and westerns and stuff, and trying to delve deep into their characteristics and, you know, see how they're still important to us culturally, even if we can't get them restored.
All right. Well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been talking about the public domain noir, The Chase, directed by Arthur Ripley. Don't forget, you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Tuesday at 7, Saturday at 1, or anytime at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com under the category Armchair Directors. Professor Dutter, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thank you very much.
For The Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying, silly law-abiding jerk.